So happy it's Thursday. Welcome. ESPN 1700 AM is the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. We are attorney heavy today. In studio with us, we are blessed with two of them.
Two heavy hitters.
I know, two heavy hitters. We have with us Will Hurley. His website, Hurley Law, SD. He's a San Diego native. Very few of those out there.
I'm one of them.
You're one of them.
You went to school in La Jolla, right?
I did. Bishops.
Bishops. Oh, yeah. My goodness. Bishops. Well, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, guys. Good to be here.
He's an estate planning attorney, as I said, right here in the area. And he brings to us the top 10 list of the top 10 most important estate planning tips. Now, we probably won't get through all of them, but we're going to get through as many as we can and elaborate on, well, the most interesting ones, not necessarily the most important, but the most interesting ones and most interesting to us.
Sure. Well, first, let me just prove I'm a lawyer by giving you some disclaimer language. People are used to hearing these kinds of things, but you cannot form an attorney-client relationship over the radio, and we don't intend to do that, nor can anything that we say today, and Kevin Cador to my left is included in this disclaimer, nor can anything we say be construed as legal advice. You have to seek an attorney-client relationship with a lawyer to form that kind of relationship. That's all the legal speak I'm going to do today.
It's for entertainment purposes only.
That's right.
Also with us, Kevin Cadora, his website, faircadora.com. I like that a lot, and you can explain exactly what fair means. One more time, faircadora.com. He's a family law attorney here in Mission Valley and studying to become a certified yoga instructor.
That's right. It helps with the practice. It helps with my everyday life, and try to do yoga every single day, and it has, in fact, saved my life from some health concerns that I had in the past. So it's something
wow,
I really
enjoy.
Wow,
that's quite a plug for yoga.
That's not the first time I've actually heard that. Remember? We had the seller that we walked to his house, and he had that pad on his floor, and he's like, yeah, yoga saved my life.
Wow, I would have never guessed. Well, your website is mentioned, Fair Cadora, F-A-I-R-C-A-D-O-R-A. Now, obviously, the Cadora part makes sense. That's your last name. Fair has a couple, maybe a double entendre when in the law business. What does that mean?
Well, Fair is the last name of my partner, Lauren Fair. We've been partners for going on 2 years, but she's also my fiance. And we run a very tight ship and a very good business together, both on and off the legal field, so to speak.
Mixing business with pleasure.
Absolutely, and it works.
It works. Okay, good. Okay, right out of the gate, estate planning tips. Top 10 most important estate planning tips. You've got a list of 10 here. Any particular order? Number one, most important. We got them alphabetical. What are we doing here?
Well, let's just talk generally about estate planning as an introduction. Most important thing to keep in mind as a buzzword is communication. The goal of any good estate plan is to accurately and concisely communicate your wishes when you're not able to do so. Makes people uncomfortable sometimes to talk about estate planning because obviously we're talking about mortality and things that we'd rather not consider. As far as an estate plan is concerned, there are several sort of broad brush issues that you want to look into. Most people want to avoid probate. In California, that roughly, in rough numbers, means if you have an estate greater than $100,000, you're going to be involved in a court process unless you take action now.
Brutal.
That could tie up your estate. Average time in San Diego County right now is about 18 months. And average fees, I think, for a mid-size estate of about $500,000, about $22,000. So it's expensive and costly to go through probate. Most people want to avoid it if they can.
So, Will, do you do probate also?
I do.
So you get a lead, say, someone says, come in here and handle this probate account?
I do.
How's that work?
Well, you know, again, most of my client are word of mouth referrals, and so if I've formed an estate plan of some kind, those relatives of those people might come to me and say, "Hey, we have a probate issue going on right now." I'm kind of like a good estate planner. I try to avoid probate court when I can. So what we're looking to do is form an estate plan that will allow people to sort of affect their wishes without needing to go to court and spending a lot of money and time over there.
Well, sure, the state of California actually has a plan for everybody.
That's true.
There's a plan already in place.
You have an estate plan.
If you don't like the plan that the state has for you, you got to do something about it, and that's where estate planning comes into play.
You're exactly right. It's a case where choosing not to decide is making a choice, and the state of California has an estate plan in place for you. It's called intestate succession. And if you do not form some sort of document for your estate plan, you will become a number in the game of intestate succession. And that's something that most people try to avoid by way of estate planning.
Just tuning in, we're talking with Will Hurley, estate planning attorney. His website is hurleylawsd.com, HurleyLawsD.com. Now, we talked a lot about estate, and you said $100,000. What does – define estate. What does that mean,
well,
to have estate?
And we're on a real estate show, so this is a good example for your purposes. If you own real property in the state of California, you're going to be subject to probate. The reason being that it doesn't matter how much of the price you've actually paid on the property. If the mortgage is greater than $100,000, your estate will be valued accordingly.
So the mortgage.
Exactly right. It's not even ownership. It's the value of the property. So if you're on the deed and the property is worth greater than $100,000, tough not to fall into that category in Southern California, if not impossible. Then you're going to be subject to probate, and you need to do something about that. What most people do is form what's called a revocable trust or a living trust during their lifetime, whereby the assets that they have, their property, is placed into a legal fiction in the form of a trust. That way it does not pass as part of that person's estate when they pass.
So we're really talking about saving taxes.
Two things: avoiding probate, the first thing. But there can be tax issues involved in an estate. The first sort of threshold tax issue is: will your estate be subject to what's called federal death taxes? Is how we refer to it. And the government just recently, in 2013, the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2013 set the estate tax exemption to $5.25 million per person. It's effectively $10.5 million per married couple that can pass by way of your estate without federal estate tax applying to it. So, again, it's a very small percentage. It's I think, about less than 1% of the total estates that pass are subject to that kind of taxation. But if you're in that category, you want to plan for it to the best of your ability.
So what do they mean when they say to step up in basis?
Well, essentially, I'll give you an example from my personal life. Say, for example, and actually I'll make it hypothetical. Say, for example, my father had a home and he was incapacitated, elderly, and in another home, not living in his primary residence. He owned the home outright. He paid $48,000 for it many years ago. If we were to sell that house while he's still alive, he would pay capital gains on the difference between what he paid for it and what it's worth today. However, if the property passes to his inheritors by way of a trust, then they get the benefit of what's called a stepped-up basis. So there's essentially no capital gains under that circumstance. And again, I'm not a tax attorney, so you want to talk to a tax attorney or a CPA when you talk about these issues. But essentially, you avoid the capital gains by way of a stepped-up basis.
You had mentioned that not the mortgage, not how much equity, but the value of the property is what determines essentially the value of your estate as far as this is concerned. And if it's over $100,000, you've got a potential probate situation. So
correct.
If you own property in California, everybody's going to be subject to probate unless they have a plan in place of their own.
Exactly right.
Why does everybody not have one of these plans in place?
It's a good question. I looked at some statistics just this morning that said about half of all adult Americans are without any estate plan.
Half.
About half.
Why?
So it's a good question. I think, again, you go back to sort of taboo issues of thinking about one's own mortality. The family dynamics might enter into it as well. There might be sort of sibling issues, and maybe the parents say, I don't want to really wade into that morass right now. Some people have privacy issues. They say, I don't really want anybody to know what my estate looks like or what it's worth. All of those things, can be effectively handled by a good estate planning attorney because, you know, you form a confidential relationship with that person and you're directly represented by them and you avoid a lot of these pitfalls. Also, you know, the good news about looking at your mortality once for purposes of an estate plan is then you can forget about it. And, you know, many years, you know, you might wake up and say, oh, my goodness, what's going to happen with my estate or what are my kids going to do? You'll go, oh, I took care of that. And you just go right back to sleep. I think a lot of people don't look at the potential ameliorative effects on anxiety of a good estate plan.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Will Hurley. His website, HurleyLawSD.com. That's the website, HurleyLawSD.com. They have on here, inventory your estate. Now, I would think a lot of people don't think that they own enough, that they have enough that it warrants going through this. So taking account and determining what you have and own that is going to pass or hopefully pass is a large part of what you do to see if it makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. And usually, you know, an initial consultation, we can take a look at all of the assets of the estate, determine what sort of tools, estate planning tools, would most be most applicable under the circumstances.
So when you set up a trust, basically you're creating an account and you've got to put items of your estate in that account so it's protected within that trust. And often I see where people will refinance their property and the banks were taking them out of the trust, and then sometimes they weren't putting them back in the trust.
Yeah.
Do you review trust to see, you know, how often do people need to review their trust?
Well, again, sort of two aspects to your question there. The first is that the technology of a good lawyer is the English language. And lawyers' technology gets better over time. And especially in the area of estate planning, what happens is people learn from the mistakes or pitfalls of previous attorneys or bad estate plans, and we adjust the language accordingly. So it's always important to have the most up-to-date verbiage in a good estate plan. And you want an attorney who knows sort of what sort of clauses have caused trouble in the past and have gotten better. With respect to titling, it's sort of a different issue. You know, the trust is a legal fiction, I called it. It really, from day to day, the day before you form the trust and the day after you form the trust, there's almost no difference in your accessibility to your property. You still own it. You still control it. There are certain mechanical aspects of making sure that the trust is accurately funded and titled, like grant deeding properties that you own into the trust, if applicable, if advisable, that later can lead to issues, for example, the one you mentioned, where there might be a refinancing issue, and for purposes of titling, the refinancing company says, no, grant deed it back to yourselves. We'll do the refinancing, then grant deed it right back into the trust if you want. So these things are sort of the ongoing mechanics of making sure that your assets are properly titled and that your property's in the name of the trust.
Well, you know, I do see banks take them out of the trust and then refinance them, put them back in the trust. It's just a moving around of paper.
Yeah.
I mean, if someone has a trust, which is a layer of protection, the bank won't loan to a trust. They'll loan to individuals. And so that's why they move them out occasionally. However, there are some banks out there that will leave the property in the trust because the trust is a way to safe haven your assets in some ways. And to take it out of the trust is risky on maybe minor levels, but still it, you know, it diffuses some of the power that the trust has at that moment if you take it out and put it back in. Also, we're seeing some people not putting them back in.
Mm. When we come back, we're going to talk to Kevin Kadora, who's going to talk about divorce litigation, top 10 issues associated with divorce litigation ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. Just heard from Will Hurley. His website, HurleyLawSD.com. That's H-U-R-L-E-Y, LawSD.com. We also have with us Kevin Kadora.
Yeah, Kevin, you know, you're a family law attorney.
I am. I've been practicing here in San Diego for the past 10 years. Like Will, I did a little probate and estate planning, but I have weeded that out of our practice, and we are solely family law practitioners at Fair Kadora, and we have offices down in Mission Valley.
In Mission Valley, that's a nice spot.
We love it. We're actually moving offices down to 600 B Street in the next couple of months, trying to stay central for all of our clients.
So, you know, one of the big topics that we're coming across right now is this issue around prenups, where, you know, people are electing to get a prenup. And some people think, well, you know, it's a good planning practice to put a prenup in place. Maybe it's not the sexiest thing to have a conversation about before you're married. What are your thoughts about prenups?
Well, I think with like with estate plans and trusts and wills, a prenup is a tool to protect assets. It's a tool to protect income. It's a tool to protect various reimbursements that a party might be entitled to if the parties do get divorced. With a prenup, you can basically contract around the community property laws within California. You can basically indicate in the prenup that various pieces of property will remain separate property. A party's income will remain their separate property income, because during marriage without a prenup, all property is presumed community property, and all community property is divided 50-50 upon divorce.
Okay, so if you have a prenup in place, can you like identify certain things in it that, like, you know, if you have an affair, I get everything?
That is a very good question, and it's a very gray area. Typically with prenups, if a prenup is against public policy, and to give you an example, a prenup that says that a party is not going to be required to pay child support is absolutely void. It's per se invalid, and a judge or a trial judge cannot enforce that type of agreement. Also, with regards to custody and visitation, if one a prenup indicates that a party is not going to be entitled to custody or visitation because they commit adultery, that is per se invalid, because custody and visitation is based on best interest of the children, not whether or not a parent engages in adultery. So really, a prenup surrounds spouse support, which you can terminate and waive through a prenup as long as both parties are represented by an attorney. And it basically is used to identify separate property assets and income that will remain separate property assets and income during the marriage. Typically, a prenup is used when there is a higher net worth individual, a spouse, and it's used to protect their assets and their income from becoming community property after the parties marry.
If you're just tuning in, we are on the line with Kevin Kedora, which is a family law attorney with FairKedora.com is your website. You can reach Kevin directly by calling 619-209-6080. That's the number. Again, 619-209-6080. So let's just say that you're married. You can see that things aren't working out, and you receive this inheritance. You don't have a prenup in place. Does this inheritance immediately become community property?
No. This is actually a two-part question, because anything that is acquired during marriage, absent a prenup, is presumed to be community property. However, inheritance rebuts that presumption, and an inheritance is a party's separate property and will remain their separate property unless that individual gifts it to the community. For example, let's say a person receives a $5,000 inheritance and wants to purchase a gift for their spouse using that inheritance. Will that individual be entitled to a reimbursement based on that gift? No. However, if an individual receives a $100,000 investment an inheritance, and then invests that inheritance in stocks or bonds, would the other spouse be entitled to a division of that investment come divorce? No, because the investment was purchased with a separate property inheritance.
So let's say that you inherit a piece of property, and then you want to refinance, pull some cash out or something like that. And in the process, you have to go through the qualifying with the loan. And lo and behold, your wife ends up on the title, right? Because you need her income to qualify for the mortgage. Now, this property was inherited, but in the process, you commingled it with the community property issues. Now it's what's the case here?
Well, it's interesting that you actually brought this up, because it sounds like an exam question for the special exam for
family law attorney. Oh, it's an exam question. I assure you of that.
They are listening.
I got the
I'm actually taking that exam in 2 weeks, and it sounds very familiar. And It really depends on several things. There's a couple of things that the court can do if this issue were to come up. There's what's called the lender intent doctrine. And basically what the court will do is look at the underlying transaction and then make a determination whether or not the lender intended the community to benefit from the transaction or whether it was a quote-unquote straw man transaction for purposes of pulling the money out of the house. So really it could go either way. It also brings up a very good point with regards to whether or not there are any community contributions to that separate property asset and whether or not there are any improvements made, because that could entitle a party to various reimbursements. So it's a very good question. It's a gray area. It could go either way. Typically the courts look to the lender intent to determine whether or not it is community or separate.
Well, I tell you what, I'm baffled by the fact that they acknowledge a straw man in that. I mean, they see that people will, you know, move things around to gain advantages.
Absolutely.
And they acknowledge a straw man.
Absolutely. And typically what the court will look to is any unfair advantage that a spouse takes when there is any type of change in characterization to an asset, what is typically called a transmutation. And a transmutation is when a separate property asset is changed into a community property asset or vice versa. And typically what happens is that a party will, like you said or mentioned, refinance property using one party's credit simply for that purpose, but the title will remain in the other spouse's name. That is an unfair advantage, and typically the court will set that type of transaction aside and thus making the asset community.
This is really interesting, and it sounds like if you can see that there's something not working out in your relationship, that really having a conversation about how to plan might be in order.
Typically, yeah, I would agree with you, but unfortunately, during those times of separation and divorce, there can be issues of domestic violence, adultery, drug abuse, alcohol abuse. Communication with your spouse is very difficult. That's not to say that I haven't dealt with clients who want to mediate their divorce, and they come in and they try to work out an amicable solution, which I advise that to every single client that walks into my door, because if you litigate an issue in family court, you both are going to spend $25,000 in attorney's fees minimum. Whereas if you come in and mediate, probably between $5,000 and $10,000 total if you can come to an agreement quickly. So, yes, if the parties can come together and try to work a plan out or work an agreement out, that is highly recommended, and any good family law attorney would agree.
Are you seeing more divorce now that the economy's being called improving?
Actually, the divorce rate has gone down. We are seeing more paternity actions where there needs to be a paternal relationship established between typically a father and a child, and that involves child support. I would say within the last 4 or 5 years, divorces, they peaked and then they steadily have gone down. Now that the economy is coming back, I see that divorces are remaining pretty much on the downward slope.
So do you draw a connection with the state of the economy and divorces?
Absolutely. And there was a time where people were not even – they weren't getting divorced simply because to get divorced was too expensive. They didn't have the finances to support two households. They were remaining together in the same household despite the animosity because they simply just didn't have the money to support two households. So, yes.
And now as the economy, let's hope, gets better – people have enough money to not have to look at each other every day?
That's
what we break it down to, right? That's the idea.
I don't want to sound too cynical, but yes, that's as a family law attorney, typically when the economy goes up and people are able to support themselves, the divorce rate will go up.
Interesting. I would have not necessarily expected that. Hmm. Well, you have here on your list here spousal support, which I would imagine is a very, very vague term. That would seem to be a pretty important thing to settle going through a divorce litigation.
Yes, spousal support is the number one litigated issue in any divorce because it's an issue in every single divorce, whereas custody and visitation sometimes is not an issue because spouses don't have children or some spouses don't have children. And spouse support is litigated so much because the supporting spouse doesn't want to pay it and the supported spouse doesn't want to lose it, obviously. And it's a very complicated issue, too, because there's two different types of spouse support. There's temporary spouse support that a spouse receives during the pendency of an action, and it's typically based upon the need and ability of the parties for spouse support plus any other applicable factor the court can consider, which I understand is very vague. But then there's also permanent spouse support, which takes into consideration a whole slew of factors, 14 to be exact, duration of marriage, the marketable skills of the supported spouse, the marital standard of living, assets and liabilities of the parties, and that's just a few. So, yes, it's a very complicated issue, and it's a very highly litigious issue.
Is there a certain amount of time that people need to be married in order to receive spousal support? Or is it from day one?
Typically, the court – it's an unwritten rule. The court will award – for marriages of under 10 years, the court will typically award spouse support for half the duration of the marriage. If the marriage is over 10 years – there is a statute under the family code that basically says the court will reserve its power to award spouse support indefinitely, typically until a party dies or the supported spouse remarries. So the 10-year mark is the buzzword with regards to spouse support, because if you're married for over 10 years, there's a high likelihood that you'll be required to pay spouse support indefinitely.
If you're just tuning in, we're on the line with Kevin Kodora, a family law attorney. His website is fairkodora.com, just like it sounds. If you want to reach out and touch base with him directly, his phone number is 619-209-6080, 619-209-6080.
When we come back, more with Will Hurley, estate planning tips. Looks like I've got here review title issues and designate powers of attorney on deck when we come back. Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. We just heard from Kevin Kodora, his website, fairkodora.com. That's the website, fairkodora.com. Talked a little bit about spousal support, prenups, and we're going to get back to the whole divorce thing, taking it apart, taking apart divorce, which is, I guess, the taking apart of a relationship there in a bit. But for now, we're going to talk about putting it together, keeping it together. Will Hurley, his website, Hurley Law SD, top 10 most important estate planning tips and how to put one together. And we talked about three of them. And I'm going to jump around to the ones that I think are most important. I see number six here, draft a guardianship provisions and wills on power over the plan for the same. What does this mean, guardianship provisions?
Well, and again, many people don't think about estate planning. They particularly don't think about estate planning when they're young. But young couples who have young children need to think about the issue of what would happen with that child and who's going to raise that child and how will that child be provided for in the event that something unforeseen takes place. That can be taken care of very easily in the form of if wills are the only document being drafted, a guardianship provision can be placed right in the will. Or in pour-over wills, in the case of a revocable trust, which we were talking about earlier, the pour-over will would designate the guardian and typically would be the same person designated as the successor trustee in the trust itself. The important parts of that can be streamlined so that the person that could end up in charge of raising this child would also be given the assets to do so.
It seems like that would be the logical way to go about it.
And it's an important part of any, you know, estate plan.
So when the kids are young, in the estate plan, you got to have someone designated as who's going to – now, if let's say you have two sets of grandparents. Now we have to decide?
Yes, and it's a good question. I mean, it's an important consideration. One of the things you want to look at is the age and relative health of the person that you're designating, because a prerequisite would be that they survive you.
So you want to make sure that's
part of it. But again – blood relationships are important because of the kind of care that they would receive and what's in the best interest of the child, which is one of the few issues that probably overlaps between Kevin's discussion and my own. Everyone should be looking at the best interest of the child, particularly if it's a minor child at that point. So.
Can I name one through four?
You can name a guardian, an alternate guardian.
Alternates.
And typically the alternates, the language that we use with alternates is if they're unable or unwilling to serve.
So, got it. Got it. Understand. Okay.
Do you recommend that you go talk to, say, your parents and say, hey, if I pass away, would you take care of my kids?
I think I started this discussion with the idea of clear communication, and my top 10 list ends with communicate, communicate, communicate. It is the most essential part of any estate plan, and what you're talking about is the best practice. Once the estate plan is in place, everyone implicated by the estate plan should meet and discuss the provisions that have been put in place so that there's not any sort of misunderstanding or mystery to what's going to happen in the event that the plan takes effect.
That seems kind of rough. I mean, people might get their feelings hurt.
There are those aspects to it. Potentially there are those aspects to it. But I think the communication now is more important. And again, if there are going to be rattled feelings or differences that need to be aired, better to do that when we're not in a situation where the estate plan's starting to take effect and could result in costly litigation or anything. You know, we were talking about litigation before, and Kevin mentioned that, you know, people are typically not prepared for the rigors of litigation. Kevin and I both do it for a living. It's not a happy place. Thomas Jefferson called litigation a machine where all men enter pigs and exit sausage. That's winners, losers, judges, jurors. So a good estate plan, a good family lawyer, a good litigator will also understand how to avoid scorched earth if that's going to burn everybody's feet.
I can see that. Now you have here power of attorney for healthcare and financial purposes. I would imagine that could be the guardian as well.
It could. So what we're really talking about is what is a comprehensive estate plan? And in addition to just transmitting assets, you want to take care of all issues that could potentially be implicated. One issue is if you were incapable of making your own medical decisions, who would make those medical decisions for you? That's called a durable healthcare power of attorney. Also, if you were incapable of making your own financial decisions, either because you were incapacitated or had passed, who's going to stand in your shoes for purposes of financial transactions with banks and payments and things that are ongoing? That's the financial power of attorney. And a good estate plan involves all of those things. Typically with spouses, they will name each other as the primary power of attorney in both those capacities. And then an alternate might be either one of their children or some close relative. Really, geographical proximity comes into play with both of those power of attorneys because you want somebody who's readily available if doctors need to talk to somebody or if financial things have to take place in short order.
Now, you talked about communication a lot. I would imagine some of these things are put in place without the named parties actually knowing. How often does that happen?
Well, you know, and again, I think some attorneys do it all the time. I think some estate planners do it that way. Some people have just a different mindset with respect to those things. I always encourage my clients, look, when you leave here and we have fully executed documents in place, everyone implicated should know what the plan is. And if they have issues, they should be brought to bear now so that we can talk about them openly now as opposed to fighting about them later.
The key word there is plan, right? Because if you plan properly, because when I look at the situation, let's just say someone passes away unexpectedly, you know, they've got their mortgage payments they're making, they're keeping the lawn up, they're, you know, doing all these things to make the house look good, and now all of a sudden, you know, the trustees, they're, or even if there's no trust at all, no one's on the bank account to take money out and make that mortgage payment. And without the proper plan in place, it seems like a disaster.
It is. It's not only a logistical nightmare, but again, California law provides for an intestate succession plan if you haven't put one in place. So they'll decide for you.
And so like they have the power to take over.
Yeah, there's a statutory scheme in place that roughly says, I mean, it's a more complex question than we have the time to discuss here today. But roughly speaking, that intestate succession deals with passing to the closest relatives that can be gleaned at the time of your demise. And if a certain number of those people cannot be determined and no other heirs can be found, you end up with an estate that can literally escheat to the state of California. And obviously nobody wants that to happen.
I'm sure the state's all right with that.
Maybe so. Well, this is one that I like. It's title issues with respect to real property. What should we be holding title as, or what's your recommendations?
Well, we talked about this a little bit before. There are two categories of assets that do not subject themselves to probate by their nature. First is a category we'll call pay on death accounts. Those are your life insurance accounts where you have a designated beneficiary and an alternate. That's a clear enough designation that it falls outside of the purview. And oftentimes those aren't, for example, a life insurance policy isn't actually part of your estate until you pass. So those stand outside of the probate process by themselves. They should stay in place. Typically, we might consider whether or not the alternate named beneficiary on some of those accounts might be the trust in the event that the primary beneficiary is not available.
I think what you're saying is that if you're listening right now and you have a relative that has not set up a trust, but they do have a life insurance policy in place, if something does happen to that person, potentially the life insurance policy will mature and it will come to you, and then you can take that money and make those payments and handle the estate while it possibly goes through probate. Is that what I'm—
That's correct. If that's part of any estate that passes, it does so outside of the purview of probate. And then the other category is something I know that's near and dear to your guys' heart. That's joint tenancy. It's a way which married couples can hold title to real property, their primary residence anyway, with a right of survivorship. A lot of married couples come to me and say, well, why not just leave it there? It's not subject to probate. If Joe dies, Mary gets it. If Mary dies, Joe gets it. What if Joe and Mary are killed simultaneously? Then we have a different issue, and it potentially could be a disaster in that there could be mortgage payments due on that house, no way to get quick access to funds in order to pay those bills, and a expensive and timely probate process tying up the mess.
So joint tenancy is one of the more common ones you're seeing.
It is. And typically with those married couples, I recommend putting the titling that particular piece of property in the name of the trust so that it will pass without the need for probate, and also will be taken care of in the event that both of the married couple pass simultaneously.
We're just tuning in. We're talking with Will Hurley. His website, Hurley Law SD, H-U-R-L-E-Y, Law SD. That's the website, Hurley Law SD. 10 most important estate planning tips. We got through about 6 or so of them. The website, you can go there for the rest of them. When we come back, we will be discussing more with Kevin Kedora about divorce litigation ahead of us. When we come back. Welcome back. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. We just heard from Will Hurley. His website, Hurley Law SD. That's the website, Hurley Law SD. Talked about 10 most important estate planning tips. We only got through 6 of them. The remaining 4, again, go to his website, Hurley Law SD. Now, Kevin, as promised, segment number 2 of divorce litigation. What do you have for us?
Well, we have, I think, a very important issue in divorce litigation, and that's domestic violence and domestic violence restraining orders because of the impact they have on the parties. Domestic violence restraining orders are very serious, and I mean serious in the affect that it can be discovered by employers. It's similar to a criminal conviction. There are unlawful communications that can be recorded without consent. Typically, when a party wants to record an individual, they either need to have a warrant or they need to have the party's consent. With a domestic violence restraining order, they can do that without the party's consent. It can affect custody. It can affect visitation, support. It can affect a topic that you guys are very interested in, and that's exclusive use of a home. Party can be removed physically by the authorities. And the domestic violence restraining order goes into the California law enforcement telecommunications system, and it's called a CLETS order, meaning that any law enforcement agent anywhere can bring up the order and enforce it.
We were looking at a home all the way out in Ramona, and husband and wife were in the middle of a not-so-amicable divorce. And the wife was in the home, husband was gone, and she was really concerned about even letting people in to view it with the fear in mind that it may be a ruse and her husband would show up and, I don't know, take stuff, be there. I don't know what it was, but it was really strange in terms of actually getting in the home, both for viewing it and the home inspection, because they had, I guess it was a restraining order, and she was very concerned that he would necessarily abide by it.
Absolutely. And with a domestic violence restraining order, it doesn't prohibit just direct contact between the parties. It prohibits indirect contact, meaning that a spouse's relative or friend cannot communicate with the other spouse with regards to what's going on with the kids or things of that nature. It can be a violation of the restraining order. A party can't carry firearms, and carrying firearms could be a punishable 5 years in prison. I mean, it's a very serious issue in family law.
So restraining orders aren't free.
Actually, they are free. The court does not charge for a domestic violence restraining order. There's actually a clinic that the party, the victim can go down and get free help with filling out the forms. They're not appointed an attorney, but they do get free help. And it's a very quick process. Typically, a hearing is set within 14 days of issuing the temporary restraining order. Actually, strike that, it's 21 days of the temporary restraining order being issued. And then there is a hearing on that, and it's analogous to a trial. You put on witnesses, you introduce evidence, and it is a very serious type of hearing.
So you have to prove that there's a reason for the restraining order?
Yes, there has to be actual abuse or a reasonable apprehension of ongoing abuse for a restraining order to issue. Typically, that is introduced by way of medical records, police reports, testimony, typically from the victim, sometimes third-party witnesses. I've been involved with some unfortunate cases where children actually get on the stand and have to testify as to what actually happened, which is tragic.
Sounds horrible.
As family law attorneys, we try to keep the children out of the divorce as well as domestic violence, but that's typically how those types of orders are issued.
You know, speaking of children, it seems to me that in a lot of divorce situations, there is possibly true, possibly false accusations of issues surrounding the children, which it seems as though that the person who gets accused is almost like guilty until proven innocent.
Unfortunately, you're correct. And typically, you see that a lot with domestic violence restraining order, but you also see that with custody and visitation matters, especially high conflict custody and visitation matters where there's allegations of parental coaching or alienation or things of that nature. But one thing that a party has to remember, that making a false allegation of child abuse or something of that nature during a family law proceedings can subject that party to sanctions, and they can be pretty heavy sanctions, including losing custody and visitation of the child. So I always advise clients, tell the truth, because the only people who matter in any divorce case are the children.
Okay, so marriage is over. You're sitting in divorce court or sitting in your office and you're trying to figure out how to divide the assets, and you suspect that your spouse may be hiding assets. What is the discovery process to determine what assets that the spouse has?
Well, the easiest way to discover assets is to hire a private investigator. And a good family law attorney has an army of private investigators. Unfortunately, that does cost money. There are other less expensive types of discovery tools that we as attorneys use, demand for production of documents. We can actually call a party into our office and depose them where they have to be, where they're placed under oath, and we ask them questions they have to answer truthfully. We can issue what are called third-party subpoenas to banks and other financial institutions, and they're required to produce the documents that we demand. So there are tools available, and it really comes down to how much money the parties want to spend on this litigation.
So this demand for production of documentation that you mentioned, so that's just you send the other opposing attorney, hey, here's the demand, prove to us what you have.
Yes, it's we typically, as family law attorneys and civil attorneys, we have boilerplate type of demands. They run the gamut of everything from their pay stubs to deeds to trusts and wills to financial statements to expenses per month and everything that you can possibly imagine, what experts they want what documents they've acquired from experts they intend on using during the litigation. So it's pretty extensive what we ask for. And they're required to produce what they have. And if they don't,
Yeah, what if they don't?
If they don't, we can bring a motion and the party can actually be sanctioned. And the sanctions can be pretty severe as the court either dismissing their responsive pleadings and the matter proceeding without them, to the court deciding various issues without the introduction of any evidence from that party, to monetary sanctions.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have a lot of questions here. I mean, for example, what if you are separated and the wife cashes in on some of the retirement assets and, you know, buys a place or something like that? I mean, are you still part of that? Or, I mean, does she get that because you haven't been divorced?
Absolutely. And very good question. It often happens because people have to tap into their investments or retirements in order to survive. She doesn't get it free and clear because if it's a community property asset, to give you an example, she has $100,000 and she takes 50 of it to live off of. She doesn't get the remaining $50,000 that is in that investment account. It simply goes to the husband. It's divided equally between the parties.
So when it comes to division of assets and debts and things like that, there are some, obviously, paperworks involved that you can work out and try to get all this information. So if you want to get a hold of Kevin Kadora at fairkadora.com, a family attorney, his telephone number, his direct line is 619-209-6080. Again, 619-209-6080.
Also, Will Hurley, our estate planning attorney, top 10 most important estate planning tips, HurleyLawSD.com, HurleyLawSD.com. That's the website, HurleyLawSD.com. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both. Please stay tuned. Tim Stromble with Sports Court coming up next.